Welcome to The Deep Dive. I'm your host, Philip McKenzie. I'm an anthropologist strategist with a focus on culture and humanity-centered design. I'm Brooklyn-born and Brooklyn-made. Every week, I will bring you guests from a wide variety of backgrounds who, despite their different areas of expertise, share traits in common. They aim high, push boundaries, and make things happen. Their experiences drive insights. On today's episode of The Deep Dive, I'm joined by Dr. Leon Prieto. Dr. Prieto is a professor of management and the director of the Center for Social Innovation and Sustainable Entrepreneurship in the College of Business at Clayton State University. He also serves as a research fellow at Cambridge Center for Social Innovation, University of Cambridge Judge Business School. He has published articles in respected academic and practitioner journals, such as Academy of Management Learning and Education, the Journal of Business Ethics, Journal of Management History, Harvard Business Review, and MIT Sloan Review. His first book, co-authored with Dr. Simon Phipps, is entitled African American Management History, Insights on Gaining a Cooperative Advantage. His scholarship has received recognition from Thinkers 50, the Academy of Management, the Think List, and the United States Association for Small Business and Entrepreneurship. And it is a pleasure for me to have Dr. Prieto with us. How are you doing today, man? It's good to have you on The Deep Dive.
Thank you. And thanks for that very gracious welcome. You know, so it's, you know, very good to join your podcast and have a conversation with you and your listeners.
Absolutely. And, my listeners are a rowdy bunch. So they're global in their locale, and they are far thinking in the way their brains work. So I'm always surprised, not so much surprised, but always encouraged when I get messages from these folks all around the world who are really engaged with the show. So they're passionate.
Good. I'm ready to rumble as well.
Okay. we're in a good place. So, you know, and I also want to give a shout out to Ed Morrison. So Ed Morrison has been at least two times on The Deep Dive, and he is how I came to be familiar with your work. He reached out to me and mentioned that he was in touch with you and your co-author around some of the work that he does. And he was like, you know, I think they would make great potential guests for the show. And then he actually introduced us. So I want to also give a shout out to Ed directly, because he has been a great guest. He's a great thinker, just another one of these great minds that's out there. And, you know, he put us in touch. So I love the fact that there's community between myself and my listeners. And I think it's kind of a perfect segue, because community is so much a part of the book. So this notion of African-American management history, I want to give you an opportunity to share why you think it's important to catalog this particular school of thought in comparison to, let's call it standard or predominantly white management history.
Yeah, definitely. I would love to talk about that. I've always been a fan of history. So when I moved to the U.S., I attended an HBCU. It's called Claflin University. And you attended HBCU as well. You went to Howard. So, you know, when you go to an HBCU, a historically black college or university, you learn a lot about black history. You know, so I took a lot of these classes, and I learned about the history of the African diaspora. But I was a business major, like you. But when I was studying business management, there was nothing really in the textbooks that really talked about entrepreneurship from an African perspective. You didn't learn about black entrepreneurs. You might hear the name Adam C.J. Walker every Black History Month, and that's it, the end. I was like, you know, that can't be right. You know, Adam C.J. Walker couldn't be the only black entrepreneur, you know? So I always found that to be a bit odd. And when I did my PhD, I took a class that was pretty much a management history doctoral level class. And it was a really good class, don't get me wrong. But there was nothing related to Black enterprise at all. And I was like, okay, there's a gap in the literature. And if I ever do become an academic or management professor, a scholar, I'm going to spend some time and do some research on African-American management from a historical perspective. So myself and my research partner, Dr. Simone Phipps, she also happens to be my better half and my wife as well. And we worked on this book, and it came out in 2019, and the rest has been a wonderful roller coaster ride. But what we really wanted to accomplish was for our students, especially those at HBCUs, could learn about Black business pioneers and the contributions that they made within their communities.
I'm glad you brought up the HBCU experience. You know, as I like to call myself or refer to myself as an overly enthusiastic Howard alum, right? Of which there are many, and we are super annoying about it in the best way. But I really can relate to your experience, because, like you said, I was also a business major. I minored in things in liberal arts, so I got to spend a lot of time in our College of Arts and Sciences building, taking different types of courses besides business courses. But I would agree that walking in the door at a Howard University and many other HBCUs, like, literally you had to take Intro to African American History. That was like, had to take it. You had to take Black Diaspora.
Definitely.
Those were right up there with Intro to Psychology and all the rest of it. And of course you can take more, but those you had to take. And that gives you a grounding in your history in a way that I think is so valuable, because American history, as it is standardly taught, actively erases the perspective of Black people in particular, but many others, Indigenous, Latino, what have you. And so having the opportunity to take classes at a HBCU or wherever you're going, that sort of fill in those grays, I think is critical. You know, so to that point, it feels like to me that the absence of African-American thought within management circles is very much in line with the purposeful erasure that we see in standard American history. You know, and I'd be curious to get your thoughts on whether or not you see it as being that dramatic. And if you do, to what extent, and to what extent you may or may not, how does that affect the way in which you had to go about creating the book?
Well, I do think it's that dramatic, as you just said, you know. So, and it was, you know, it's a crying shame that a lot of our stories, our narratives were left out, omitted, or however someone chooses to describe it. And I've received some backlash from some folks who felt attacked because I criticized the fact that a lot of American history was omitted. You know, so I couldn't believe people were outraged, because I was outraged based on a lot of history being left out, you know? And we do ourselves a disservice by not providing a complete and more inclusive education for all parties involved. So this history is not just for African Americans, it's for all of us. You know, the same way we learn about Henry Ford and Frederick Taylor and Henry Fayol and some of the pioneers who are white, why not learn about African American pioneers? Why don't we learn about business pioneers from the continent of Africa or Latin America or Asia? You know, so every region in this world have their own unique philosophies that we can learn and grow from. And I'm a firm believer that we need to learn from history to chart our way forward. And we need to stop being so ethnocentric and just focus on American history. Standard American history. There are a lot of things we can learn from many cultures right here in the United States and other parts of the world to make this capitalistic economic system a much more inclusive, a much more humanistic system. Because right now, unbridled capitalism is causing so much problems in this world. And the list is too long for me to even list right now, you know, so there's work to be done, and there's more histories of these hidden figures to be unearthed. you know? So it's time to get to work. Instead of criticizing me, just join in and let's get this work done together.
Yeah, I mean, there's a tremendous opportunity to fill in these blanks. And I'm glad you mentioned a humanistic approach to capitalism, because we're gonna spend some time there. But before we get there, I want to talk about this idea that you mentioned, you know, understanding history is a way to chart a path forward, you know, and very early on in the book, I think it's like on page one, you talk about the idea behind Sankofa, this going back to get it concept. And I want to give you an opportunity to share why that concept is so central to your work, because it's a notion that I think is unfamiliar in larger non-Black circles.
Yeah, so you articulated it beautifully. Sankofa means go back and get it. It's an Akan word, so the Akan people from Ghana. And that word resonates with a lot of us from the African diaspora, because, you know, I grew up in the Caribbean. You grew up in the real Brooklyn, you know, so a lot of people from many different parts of the African diaspora and other parts of the world reside in Brooklyn. So this concept of Sankofa, it's very important to many of us from the diaspora who have been cut off from the continent. So we have this yearning and this hunger for everything Africa. So that's why the movie Black Panther was just so important to our community. It transcended being like a comic book movie. You know, it represented Afrofuturism while reflecting on the past as well, you know? So the concept of Sankofa, it means a lot for a lot of us in the diaspora, because it allows us to really truly connect with the continent and its philosophies, its many philosophies and its ways of life that can play a big role in making capitalism a much more humanistic system. Because when people talk about humanism, they usually think about Western humanism, which is different from African humanism. You know, so one concept in African humanism is Ubuntu, which means I am because we are. And it really embraces this whole concept of community and cooperation that was pretty much a big part of African society. So this notion of Sankofa means we need to go back to that, spirit of cooperation and that community-oriented mindset that made us strong as a people, because we know of sayings like, it takes a village, you know, so we really need to embody sayings like that. We need to really go back, embrace Sankofa, go back and learn about a lot of our rich men and women, rich philosophies, rich traditions that sustained our communities. And you grew up in Brooklyn, you probably heard about something known as Susu, which is...
This is all in my notes.
Definitely, you know. So that's just one example of an African economic philosophy. It was, it originated in West Africa, so places like Ghana, Nigeria, they still call it Susu. I thought it was a Trinidadian thing growing up in Trinidad. Yeah. I was part of a Susu. It's pretty much a rotating savings credit organization, you know, where we can use it to save money. You know, it's a big part of my life growing up. It's a big part of Jamaicans and people from Barbados, Guyana. They may have different names for it. So they'll call it Susu or Box Hand or Partner or Chama in Kenya. But it's just one philosophy that we use within Africa and the African diaspora for us to build wealth as a community. You know, so we need to go back to some of these traditions that helped sustain our communities in the past.
There's two things in there. I'm going to stay on the Susu point because it's the most recent one, but I want to go back to Ubuntu as well. Both are the top part of my notes. So you're like reading my mind, my friend. The Susu is very significant, which is why I wanted to spend some time on it, because I grew up, and my mom worked at a Sephardic home and my dad worked for himself, but she was the one who had like coworkers, right? That were all, I think almost everybody was West Indian. There were a couple of women there that were also Puerto Rican, but you know, almost everybody else was West Indian. And while working at the Sephardic home, they had like a susu, or what they call like their meeting turn, right? Which was everybody threw in, you know, because there's some interesting dynamics that I want to like give our listeners who are likely unfamiliar with this that I think are important, is like basically you have, it could be any number of people. What my experience has been, it was usually like 10 to 15 people, and it would fluctuate based on who left the job, who joined the job, that kind of stuff. But in my mom's case, it was 10 to 15 people. And then each week, each person put in, I think for them, it was maybe $50. It might have grown to be $100, but this is like 80s, right? So I'm trying to reference the money was bigger back then. You know, $50 meant more then than it means now. But anyway, each person would put $50 in. So let's just make it an easy number. 10 people, $50 each. And then one person each week would get the $500, right? And then it would just keep going around and around and around until everybody in the group got it. And then it would start all over again, right? And so this was significant because it was, you know, every X number of weeks, we knew my mom was getting this $500, right? And that allowed her, in our case, to like buy the shit that we needed, right? So we were counting down the meeting turn as much as everybody else, because I was like, oh, that's my chance for them sneakers, you know, when that $500 comes in the door. And I think why it's very different from traditional capitalist models that are Western based is that there's no interest involved in it, right? So if those who might be familiar with like David Graeber's work with debt and things like that, this idea of interest is a very unique Western adjunct to capitalism, right? So I wanted to dive deeper into that because I think there's several elements of it beyond the communal point that are significant, right? There's a notion of sacrifice. Everybody has to chip in or it doesn't work, right? And there has to be trust or it doesn't work, right? So, you know, how do you think those elements have sort of supported the notions of things like a susu, or as you mentioned, other collaborative ways of building wealth that exist in this diasporic community?
Oh, yeah. So, you know, you hit a nail on the head, you know, so trust is a central component of forming a susu. And to be quite frank, and I will be frank on this podcast, a lot of times today, we see a lack of trust within our own community. You know, there are some folks who have totally bought in to the whole Western notion of rugged individualism. And they lose sight of the fact that our community was one that shared some unique values, and trust was a big part of it as well. You don't just invite anyone to a susu, you got to trust that person. But a lot of times we tend to forget our identity as a people. And because of the lack of trust that's endemic in a lot of our communities now, you see some of these traditional systems dying out. And unfortunately, there are some unscrupulous individuals who have co-opted the name susu and started these pyramid schemes that have harmed this traditional economic system that our ancestors played a big role in. And that has also eroded the trust that people have in this system known as susu, right? You know, so trust is a central component, and sacrifice as well. You know, for people of African descent, sacrifice has always been a very major part of our upbringing. You know, so you mentioned you grew up in Brooklyn, and many of your ancestors came from the Caribbean, and a lot of time that involved a lot of sacrifice. You know, like for me in particular, for me to get to the United States for college, I joined the susu, and the money I saved from that susu helped me buy a plane ticket. When my friends were out partying and everything, I was busy trying to save my money any which way I can. I had money in the bank, yes, and other financial instruments as well, but I also utilized my community economic system, which was a susu, you know, and the susu I joined, it was also part of my organization. I work for this oil company, and it was a bunch of older men And I think we needed to contribute, I want to say, $300 a week, which was a lot of money for me at the time. So yeah. they were skeptical about, who's this young boy trying to join this big man Susu, you know? But, you know, they knew I was a good kid and they allowed me to join. And I was able to save some money to buy that plane ticket and to purchase some books when I attended college. And being part of my community helped make this happen.
Yeah.
You know? So sacrifice and trust are very important components of joining any SUSU.
Absolutely. I mean, and that's a nice size nut there, that $300 a week.
Oh yeah.
You know?
Oh yeah. And they were like at least 10 people, as you said. And so when I received my hand, it was $3,000, you know?
Yeah. That's significant. It definitely does make a difference, you know. And you know, we're going to segue into Ubuntu, right? Because this is where we can start to really get into the weeds about the book and some of the, you know, really compelling ideas around it. Because Ubuntu, like you mentioned, there's this spiritual connection to people, and when you apply these principles, they can be significant in a corporate environment. And one of the things that I found challenging is squaring these ideas with countervailing ideas of capitalism as a system, right? One of the things I really focus on is understanding, you know, through my definition of culture, like systems have values, and the values of those systems is what creates the culture of those systems, right? So the way in which you talk about the humanistic approach that is Western versus a humanistic approach that is more diasporic and or African in its origins, those distinctions, which we'll likely get to, at least judging by my notes, are likely a function of the underlying values that exist in those systems. So when I hear about Ubuntu and other things being used in a business perspective, particularly one that is capitalist, right? My curiosity kind of comes up where I'm like, are those things possible to coexist? And so that's the first question. Is it possible to coexist? And two, an addition to that is when I look out at American business, right, there is a lot of talk about like wellness and purpose. And most of that is bullshit, right? So it's like, you know, they will give this overlay of concern that's really just to not let you see that they fucking you over, right? So I want to give you an opportunity to expand on that, but I threw that last bit in to kind of just give a little bit of context of where I'm coming from with the what might be perceived as skepticism.
Yeah, there's a lot of BS in corporate America. There's this scholar based in England. He wrote this book called Business BS. Pretty much, you know, so there's a lot of, you know, co-opting of these terms to make capitalism seem friendly, you know, conscious capitalism and all these things. You know, we could debate all day long whether these are just fads or these are just terms they use to portray their companies in a positive light. But recently, the UN Secretary General, in the conversations about climate change, he mentioned that there's a need to cooperate right now. He said, cooperate or perish. And I listened very closely when he said that. So even if companies don't buy into this whole notion of Ubuntu and trying to gain a cooperative advantage, we are headed to a path of destruction, right? And I hate to sound so grim when I say that, but based on what's happening with this planet right now, due to the lack of biodiversity, all of these carbon emissions, and the destruction of a number of carbon sinks like the rainforest throughout this world and so forth, and companies just getting richer and richer and just polluting many black and brown communities, and there's no real sense of justice, no real sense of social justice. And you will just see these companies put up some ad talking about, you know, we love black and brown people, especially when George Floyd got murdered. They were talking about all the things they're going to do as it relates to racial justice, social justice, environmental justice. That was just, it was just a whole bunch of BS. But we need to move beyond the BS and actually get the work done, because Ubuntu requires work on ourselves, right? So the components of Ubuntu is spirituality, dialogue, and consensus building. So this was a, this definition of Ubuntu came from a scholar by the name of Bangura. That's how we defined the tenets of Ubuntu. And this notion of spirituality, the spirit of care and community, it should come from an authentic place. And in the Western world, a lot of the times they base capitalism on the works of Adam Smith. You know, he wrote Wealth of Nations. And they tend to focus in a very myopic way on a couple of pages in his book called Wealth of Nations. They focus on the invisible hand and the need to, you know, maximize returns and all these different things. But they forget that Adam Smith, their hero, he also wrote a book called A Theory of Moral Sentiments. And that book stressed the importance of sympathy, as he called it. But what he meant back then was really empathy. This human condition of being empathetic and looking out for the welfare of each other. But they tend to exclude that book from conversations, but they focus more on Wealth of Nations and this whole notion of just being profit-driven and to everyone else be damned, you know? So this whole notion of Ubuntu can get us back to that humanistic place. And I don't mean Western humanism. Because when those philosophers in France and in England came up with their whole notion of Western humanism, they weren't thinking about Black folks. You know, we were not part of the equation, you know, but a more African-centric version of humanism, which embraces everyone, right? So we need to go back to that. But unfortunately, it's going to be a long, slow, painful process for us to go through this shift of mindset, right? So companies, they need to invite members to join their boards, and they can't just invite members who are just like them, right? If you have 10 capitalists, unbridled capitalists on a corporate board, what do you think the outcome is going to be? So corporate boards need to incorporate folks from a social justice background, environmental justice background, who are truly passionate and authentic and who was actually causing good trouble, right? So you can't have a whole bunch of unbridled capitalists on a corporate board and expect to have racial justice and environmental justice as some of the outcomes of these companies. So you need to have firebrands on there to guide the company where they're supposed to be.
But I guess that's kind of at the core of my question, right? Of kind of my leading statement that's going into a question, right? Is that the very nature of capitalism does not allow for us to address the structural things that you've talked about, right? Like racism is like it only operates under those conditions, right? Which are extractive, whether it's through racial capitalism or the destruction of the environment. If you take those things out of the mix, and this is, you know, me on a soapbox, right?
Yeah.
You know, there could be different opinions, right? In my mind, if you take those things out of the mix, then it's no longer capitalism. It only works if it's extractive. Or else it's something else, right? Like the very core of it comes extraction. Right, whether through labor or through resource. So, like, if I introduce something else, then it's not capitalism, right? Like Coca-Cola's board, and I'm just picking on Coca-Cola. You're in Atlanta, you know, so this just came to my mind, right? But I guess that proves the power of capitalism. That when I think of companies, Coca-Cola is one of the first ones that comes to mind. The big red bank, right? Mm-hmm. Can they operate if they're not extractive, right? Like that sweet Coke has to come from somewhere, right? Like, you know, there's some trees, there's some forest being burned down, there's some it being shipped from place to place. I mean, I drive and I see Coca-Cola trucks all the time. You can't miss it, right? Coca-Cola Red is its own specific red. Mm-hmm. but you can insert any company.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's where I wrestle with this stuff, right? Because in my mind, capitalism is spiritual.
Yeah.
In the sense that it is the prevailing religion that runs the world. I mean, people can say other things, but I'm like, nah, it's all capitalism. And everything flows from that.
And like any religion, it can evolve, religion stem from spirituality, and so there's an evolution from 12 guys sitting around trying to convert the masses into these, the Vatican and all these organizations now that tell us how to live our life, you know. Capitalism can evolve, and it has different shapes and forms in different parts of the world. So capitalism in China it operates a little bit differently from, you know, capitalism in the Western world, you know. So they have a more form of state capitalism over there. And it's an evolving thing. And the thing about capitalism is, think of it like a Pandora's box. You know, the box is open. The genie is out the bottle. So there's no putting it back in. So all we can do is try to make this system less extractive to the point where it's hurting people. And we have to be very thoughtful about it, right? You know, so there's this big movement right now on sustainability and renewable energy and all these things. But to make that work, there's still a very extractive component, you know, that goes into some of these new technologies and these new renewable energies that they want. For example, cobalt, right? Which is very much present in Congo. It's a mineral, and we need it for our cell phones, and we need it for a number of technologies that will help with renewable energy. And in the same token, people are talking, yes, you know, we're pioneering renewable energy, but at the same time, there's cheap labor in the Congo, people working in deplorable conditions, extracting these minerals and getting paid cents or very meagerly, very tiny incomes these people are generating. And these corporations are getting wealthier and wealthier. So this extractive component of capitalism, as you mentioned, it's troubling. And there's a lot of work to be done. And I could teach an entire class, you could teach an entire class based on that philosophical question. You know, what can we do about the extractive component of capitalism? And all I will say to it is this, as an economic system, it has to evolve, right? If it does not evolve, we are doomed.
Well, isn't that the thing, right? Like, I think these folks are happy with the doom, right? Like, in the sense that when I look at what I call like the dummies, right? Like, people who like listen to the show know that there's like a cadre of people that I shit on all the time, right? And I consider them to be, quite frankly, dummies, right? That's why it's a perfect word for them, right? Because it takes them down to a great level because they don't take them seriously, right? Like, part of their movement to leave Earth is because they're looking for the new markets, right? And in the same way, like a genocidal murderer like Columbus set sail looking for new markets, it's kind of like, okay, we've sucked this shit dry, so now let's figure out some other thing, some other place to go to find some other uncharted territory, right? Because there is no place where Coke has no more new markets, right? The only new markets they have are the people who have not yet been born that haven't tasted Coke, right? So that's the new market. There's no new place for them to go to and put up a Coca-Cola vending machine. That should exist everywhere. So I say that to say that when we talk about the, you know, the genie is out of the box, right? Can we concede territory to this system if we know the system is pushing us toward doom? Like, that's the system's goal, right? Because it's just rapacious. It has no capacity to do anything other than what it does. And those who are in service to it just assume that they'll be able to magician themselves out of its worst effects over the course of all of us, right? So what I'm trying to get at is, you know, can we use these principles to come up with something other than this, right? Because I have trouble seeing these principles fixing that thing. right? So can these, the root of these systems, can the root of all the people in this book be used to come up with something else, right? And I don't know what the something else is, right? Like if I did, I'd be doing something else, right? It'd be how we talked about at the beginning of the conversation. I'd be chilling if I knew the answers to these questions, which is why I try to talk to smart people like yourself to help me work through it. Right. So what's your initial reaction to that provocation, I guess?
Well, yeah. Well, let me preface my response by saying one of the motivations for my book, I like to read the works of other scholars who focus on Africana studies. So there's a scholar by the name of Jessica Gordon Nemhard. She's a New Yorker, and she wrote this book called Collective Courage. And the book outlined African-American history when it comes to forming cooperatives or co-ops, right? So it's considered to be like alternative type stuff, you know, the solidarity economy is considered kind of fringe, but I don't consider it fringe at all. I consider it a solution, right? Or one type of solution or one type of approach that's more community oriented in terms of how we manage our enterprises. And solidarity economy, there's a big social justice component in it. So it's not extractive as capitalism. And there's a movement, it's a small movement, but the people who are involved in it, they're very passionate about it. And there's a movement, not just in the United States. And there's some people in different parts of the U.S. who are very passionate about this movement. For example, in Brooklyn, there's people who are very much into cooperatives. In Jackson, Mississippi, there's this movement called Cooperation Jackson. And there are Black folks who are trying to own their own enterprises in a democratic fashion. And they're trying to do things differently. You know, so it's a more people-oriented approach to managing enterprises. And in Spain, you know, this movement is prevalent as well. But can it replace capitalism? Well, it's going to be a bloody fight, to be very honest with you. And we just need folks like yourself, folks like me, folks like Dr. Jessica Gordon Nemhard to continue what we're doing and educate folks about alternatives to what we consider the norm. Because the normative or the status quo, it's broken. It is broken, right? And folks, you know, they want to make their profits. They want to extract minerals. They want to utilize cheap labor. They want to keep creating these, they want to keep promoting the gig economy. Yes, it put money in some people's pocket, but it's still extractive, you know? So we have to do a better job educating folks about the alternative, but the alternative need to become the normative. But it starts,
Absolutely.
It starts with education, because we are still miseducating Negroes. You know?
There's a lot of that. And, you know, I feel like the system, the one thing I'll offer as just a different frame is that the system, I think it actually working as it's intended, right? I think it works perfectly. If you're looking at the systems as a way of just crushing us, you know, if that's the system's goal, right? Like a mafia boss. I'm kind of rewatching The Sopranos right now for like the umpteenth time, so I have a lot of mafia shit in my head. But you know, they talk about you know, you don't want to bleed a customer dry, right? You want to keep them around so they can keep paying you, right? So you don't actually want to like kill them, right? Because then you just lost your money. And when we talk about things like the gig economy that you referenced, I feel like so much of this is the culture where they've got us thinking that the worst elements of this, we're the ones actually signing up for it, right? In the sense of hustle culture, for example, right? Like that is a very specific ideology that comes out of the Black community, right? Like we're going to hustle, right? And then that's been co-opted by, you know, other dummies like Gary Vee and other sorts of people that are like trying to sell it and tedify it into like an ideology of like, oh, this is your opportunity to become your own boss, right? Because now we have all these tools that have been created that allow us to hustle and hustle harder and do more. And I'm like, hustle for what, right? Like I, you know, living in New York, I drive around and I'm like, all these people delivering food are risking their life for some rich assholes like tacos, right? Like they're willing to like speed in front of my car just to deliver this thing because the app grades them on how fast they get there, right? So it's like we've taken the worst of the management theory of like a tailor and weaponized it, and these people think they're actually like entrepreneurs.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So how do we hold that apart, right?
You know, this culture of capitalism, you know, it you know, a lot of us, we drank the Kool-Aid, you know, and in our mind, it tastes so good, you know, but...
Kool-Aid is delicious.
But it's not nutritious.
Oh, man. It ain't nutritious for shit, but man, when I was a kid, you could just show me some Kool-Aid and I would be like Pavlov's dogs. Because one, my parents, you know, you would understand this because we West Indian brothers together. My parents wasn't buying shit that was a name brand thing. So if I had Kool-Aid in the house, it wasn't real Kool-Aid. It was like the ShopRite off-brand version of Kool-Aid. You know, the pitcher's a little off shape. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But it was, you know, you pour enough sugar in it. it got you there when you were seven. But go ahead, drinking the Kool-Aid, brother. I had to take a divergence.
Exactly. And that's a good analogy for capitalism. Put some sugar on it, you know, stir it up. You know, we drink it. You're like, okay, you know, gig economy, I'm my own boss. But are you? Are you really your own boss? You know, you're just part of this wider system being exploited by, you know, by a lot of folks, you know, a lot of rich folks. So we have been miseducated about capitalism in general. And in business schools, we don't really talk about it. You know, we don't really talk about capitalism as a philosophy, as an economic system, and the negative impact of unbridled capitalism to many of our communities, you know, Black, brown, white, Latino, because there are white folks who were exploited too, you know? And that's a whole other conversation.
What I call the firefighter whites.
Exactly. That's a whole other conversation. A whole other conversation. But we drank the Kool-Aid, and a lot of us just rather stay in ignorance and not learn about this economic system and how can we reform it if possible. It may be impossible, right? But I'm willing to fight, to be very honest with you. You know, I'm not just willing to just be like, oh, well, you know, I'm just going to let the wind blow me to the left and to the right, you know? So I'm going to keep preaching about my community and the influence of Africa and how we did things, how we managed things, how we actually engendered social justice at the same time as wealth building as well.
Absolutely. And I'm all for that fight. You know, my fight is to bring forth something new, right? Like people who are listeners of the show will hear me say, like, I'm not interested in having like the, you know, socialist versus capitalist conversation. I'm like, I have enough space in my head to be like, are those my only two choices? Right. Like we live in a world with a myriad of choices. Like all of this shit is just made up at the end of the day. These are not natural laws of the way the universe, it's not gravity.
Yeah.
Right. Like this is not the way these worlds work. Yeah. These are systems that we've all agreed upon to some extent. You know, some of us might be a little bit more in agreement than others, but they are all flexible and possible for change. Right. And I think the Black experience within these systems is so unique, which is why I'm excited to have the conversation, excited about the book, because we have had the ability to live within these systems and keenly understand them while also being, you know, the systems has also kept us from opportunity without access to capital, with, you know, the legal structures being able to take away property, to take away your life. And so those things really matter, right? And so what I wanted to give you an opportunity to is talk about that backdrop, because that's a very significant backdrop. I remember a report five years ago or so, there was a report about the borrowing costs. We both went to HBCUs. that HBCUs actually have a higher cost of borrowing than other comparative universities. So it's not like they're comparing a regular HBCU against like Harvard, you know, but they're saying like, if you look at these two schools in their, the way they align, the white school's cost of borrowing is less than the black school. And why this is important is because, you know, schools borrow money and issue bonds to do any number of different things, right? To pay professors like yourself, to fund research, to build infrastructure for the university, housing, and other things like that. So if the cost of borrowing is more expensive, you just do less of it, right? Like that's the repercussion of that. So I'm kind of throwing all this out there to say that the very system itself that we're trying to manage works against our success on any number of different ways. So are we going to, you know, economic our way out of these conditions, right? Or are there other levers and buttons and devices that we need to use to get us where we need to go?
I'll preface this by saying, well, you mentioned you focus on what is new, what is novel, which is fine. And as a people, I've always felt that people of African descent have always found a way to turn nothing into something, right? So we have the thinkers, and I believe we have the doers, you know. They may not be the loudest voices out right now. You know, there are folks, as you referenced, talking about, you know, hustle hard and make that money and all these things, you know. But we do have that creative spirit, and a lot of our young people are not satisfied with the status quo. And I'm not satisfied with corporations telling young folks, oh, learn how to code, learn how to code, 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 code. As if you could just code your way into a middle class, upper class life.
Yeah. The STEM obsession is awful.
Yeah, you know, so it seems as if you're trying to turn our young people into just another cog, you know, another instrument to be used, right? So when it comes to something new, we need to reimagine what education should be, right? And yes, it's also important to learn how to do things, but our young people need to learn how to think for themselves. And, you know, people talk about critical thinking, they just use that term and it almost sounds passé, but we really do need critical and revolutionary thinkers as well, all right? You know, people, yeah, their ideas might sound half-baked for those who are still living in a matrix, but there's some of us who have some ideas, and these ideas need to be nurtured. And I believe our HBCUs, our historically black colleges and universities, need to stop being like white schools and embrace our identity, utilize some type of approach to figure out, okay, what are the problems facing our communities? How can we truly figure out what do our communities need? Then we have to problem solve, and then we have to come up with the ideas in which how can we fix these problems. And some of these fixes might be simple, some will be much more complex, but we need to empower our students to be able to tackle some of these issues. And I'm just using HBCUs because you referenced it, but that education needs to start much earlier. Right?
Absolutely.
It needs to start much earlier. From the time they're 3 years old and going to marching off to Montessori school or preschool, you know, we need to train our, I hate to use the word train, but empower our students to come up with new ways of thinking, new systems and things like that. But we need to challenge them. And the way we were educated, honestly, was inadequate, you know?
Yeah. It's weird because I feel like there's a lot missing. Like I said, like if I think about going through grade school and all that kind of stuff, it's weird. What I'm going to say sounds like it's in total conflict with one another, but it was insufficient because on its basis, like I said, American education is insufficient, right? Like it's built to indoctrinate you into being an American. So it's going to leave out a lot, anything that is inconvenient to an American story of exceptionalism is going to leave out.
Yeah.
And you know, genocide and slavery are clearly an anathema to American exceptionalism. So those are largely left out. Mm-hmm. So in that sense, it was inadequate. But then on the other side, I feel like there was quite a bit of rigor that gave me the ability to be a critical thinker or others, right? That seems to be missing now. Like maybe this is just I'm old man talking, but when I look at what people are like learning in school now, I'm like, really? This is where we're settling in on like the work. Like the workload is not as good. The work is not as rigorous. So you, even when I was young, I realized shit was missing because they were, in a way, they were giving me enough for me to figure out, like, you're not giving me the whole story, right? And so that made me curious to find other shit, right? Because, you know, they made Roots, right? So they fucked up and made Roots. And then Roots was like, I could learn some other shit about this stuff, right? So it's like they didn't know what they were doing, right? Now I feel like they don't even do that. Like there's no more Roots.
Yeah, I get it.
There's no more eyes on the prize, right? Like there's none of those things that, because those things got me to Howard, right? Like watching Eyes on the Prize, 1987, PBS here in New York, Channel 13, made me want to go to a Black university, right? It changed my life.
Mm.
And I feel like nowadays they're like, nah, we ain't doing that no more. Yeah. we just giving them more sugar for that Kool-Aid.
Yeah, and that's a problem. And that's a problem, you know. So, you know, I give kudos to those who start these organizations with STEM and all these things, but let's help our students become more than just employees, you know, that feed the beast, you know. So, and that's the thing. And to be honest with you, you know, growing up in Trinidad, and we inherited a education system based on the British system. And we were just being trained to become employees. I had no aspirations, really, to become a
change. The British civil servant.
Exactly.
Right?
Exactly. You were just a change maker. I wasn't challenged to be a change maker of any kind or an entrepreneur. It was just to be a civil servant of some kind. And the same thing is in Barbados and Jamaica and in other parts of the Caribbean as well. You know, so we inherited this system, you know, from the Western world. But education can be so much more, you know. So I would love to see a sequel to The Miseducation of the Negro.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, one that
Carter G. Woodson.
Exactly. One that considers ways in which we can change a system, right? But it's going to take a lot of work, and a lot of folks are happy with the status quo.
Yeah, absolutely.
So that's why we need folks like yourself and folks like me to speak loudly and passionately and firmly.
Yeah, and carry big books.
And a big stick as well.
Yeah.
The books alone help.
At least we ain't pulling out the cutlass. Not just yet, but I tell people if they want to get my frame, Nat Turner it. I'm walking in every room with Nat Turner energy, so that cutlass ain't far behind.
Exactly.
You know, I want to get to the final two segments of the show, which are Off the Dome and The Drop. And I only have one Off the Dome question for you. The book, you know, has so many great examples beyond Madam C.J. Walker. Like she is mentioned in the book. Mm. But I think one of the things I really loved about it that you went to great pains to talk about Black thinkers and entrepreneurs, Charles Clinton Spalding as one, and the book is filled with many others, with their work, their expertise, their leadership principles, and how they use those principles to grow businesses and to be economically successful. So again, that's culture, right? So I look at, you know, we've had three Steve Jobs movies, right? Like all of this is indoctrination to us to have a frame in our mind of the, what does an exceptional person look like, right? Whether it's the Steve Jobs movies, whether it's, you know, The Social Network, like particularly now we're telling this story of like tech weirdos who are socially awkward, but that's part of their genius, right? They're mercurial geniuses, right? And these have real world implications because we just recently saw $2 billion flushed down a cryptocurrency hole where Black and brown founders can't seem to find money, right? So the fact that people are so tied to these mental models of what an entrepreneur looks like, they're willing to give these idiots money, right? So that's my setup for my off the dome question. So given that we have an entire culture and machine that's dedicated to creating this mythology of business, if you could choose maybe someone from your book or another person that we give the Hollywood biopic treatment to, who would that person be?
Ooh, I would love to make a number of movies, but I would love to see a movie about Du Bois. Can I give an explanation why?
Yeah, of course. Yeah, okay. Yeah.
And the reason I chose Du Bois, and I used to be very critical of Du Bois before I actually read a lot of his stuff. Because I was like, what is this BS he's talking about with talented tent? And, you know, you need the educated black folks to take charge of the rest of us, you know? But that's just kind of a myopic view of, you know, his work. One reason I like Du Bois is he challenged the status quo. He saw what was happening in America. He understood the whole race question and this whole idea of double consciousness that black folks go through and the challenges that we face. And he felt that we can learn from our African ancestors and come up with our own solution that could be a better one than the capitalistic economic system. He did not care for the capitalistic economic system at all. He wanted to create his own, he wanted his own system based on the principles from Africana philosophies, right? So he believed in economic cooperation from an African perspective. And he wanted us to create our own cooperative system or ecosystem that we could thrive in. And at a time in the United States when he had these ideas, of course, Jim Crow was still very much alive. And he felt that we could survive and thrive in spite of Jim Crow and segregation, etc. So Du Bois is deserving of a robust movie, not just a passing character in somebody else's movie.
Yeah. Let's give him a full greenlit series on Netflix.
Oh, yeah.
Right? To go through all his life. If they could, well, Netflix didn't do that, but if something like Amazon Prime could waste $500 million on that terrible Lord of the Rings series, if we could find some money under the couch to put something together for W.E.B. Du Bois, next level thinker for sure.
Exactly. And not the made for TV version, because the Netflix treatment of the Madam C.J. Walker movie, it was, I didn't like it at all.
Yeah, that was awful.
Yeah.
And, you know, it had talent was present on screen, but that shit was bad on a lot of levels. Like I could devote an entire show to that Madam C.J. Walker kind of mini series, but that shit sucked. So I want to get us to the drop, and the drop is where we give anything at all to our listeners, something they could read, watch, experiment with. Could be anything at all. My drop is an anime series. I'm a big nerd, and it's called Spy Times Family, and it's available on Hulu now, but I started watching it on Crunchyroll, which is a subscription streaming service focused solely on anime. So that's just how deep I go in this. And it's just a really well done show. I won't give the whole thing away, but it's like three people come together to form a family, and they all have hidden agendas within the construct of this family. And so it's funny. It's kind of quirky. It's just a really good watch. And it's called Spy Times Family. Available either on Crunchyroll or on Hulu, and that's my drop.
Okay,
you're up, my friend.
Yeah, I gotta check that out. You know, because I'm a weird kind of business professor. I really like philosophy and things like that. And my drop is a book written by a gentleman of Jamaican descent. He passed away, I want to say, 1 year ago. His name is Charles W. Mills, and he wrote this book called The Racial Contract. So he was a professor, I can't remember what university. I think he was teaching somewhere in New York.
Yeah, I think it's at Columbia or CCNY, one out of the two. It's weird that I would have those two together, but he definitely was was teaching here.
Yeah, might be a CUNY school, I think.
Yeah, I think so, actually.
Yeah, so he wrote this book called The Racial Contract that really challenged us to think about a lot of these topics we're talking about, even though he didn't address some of these topics directly. But he was talking about how Western humanism didn't really care much about Black and brown folks, you know, and it wasn't really written for us, you know. So the racial contract, it really challenges this whole notion of the social contract and who was it written for, right? And this have a lot of implications as it relates to capitalism, the way we manage our businesses, and this whole concept of extraction within many communities in the global South and marginalized communities right here in the United States. So we have to keep in mind that capitalism, slavery was the incubator, you know, for capitalism. So that's where the whole extraction component came from. So that book had us have me really thinking about how we can really make changes to the system. I know you're saying we need to get rid of the system, but it's a good book for your viewers to really, listeners can really take in and really think about some ideas in which we could make some changes in this world.
Absolutely. He's another next level thinker, you know, so a huge loss to our intellectual communities when Charles Mills passed away. It's a lot of big thinkers in this West Indian community.
Oh, yeah. The list is long.
Brother, I want to thank you so much for joining me on the deep dive. This was a great conversation, one that I was really looking forward to. The book is really a fantastic read. I can't recommend it enough. Again, it's African American Management History, Insights on Gaining a Cooperative Advantage. Shout out also to your significant other as a co-author. She couldn't join us, but I'm glad that you were able to make it. And great work, and thanks again for being on the Deep Dive.
Thanks for having me.
You can listen to The Deep Dive via Apple Podcasts and our website, thedeepdivepod.com. Download, subscribe, listen, and share. If you like what you're hearing and enjoy what me and the team are putting together, then leave us a review. We'd love to hear from you. You can follow me on Twitter via @FarFlungPhil. To all my listeners, wherever you are in the world, I thank you. See you on the other side.